Paraphrasing the Birmingham, Alabama Separation of Races Ordinance, Section 369, it shall be unlawful to serve food in a restaurant at which white and colored people are served in the same room unless separated by a solid partition extending from the floor upward to a distance of 7 feet or higher, and unless a separate entrance from the street is provided for each race. Section 859, it shall be unlawful for any person in control of any location, indoors or outdoors, to which both white persons and Negroes are admitted, to permit any program of any kind without distinctly separate entrances, exits, and seating or standing sections assigned to the use of white persons and Negroes. It shall be unlawful for any person to engage in any performance or program in any establishment, knowing that complete separation has not been complied with. The chief of police and the members of the police department shall have the right and duty to disperse any gathering in violation of this ordinance and to arrest anyone guilty of violating the same. This was the Birmingham, Alabama home of Ed Harris as a child. Walter Edward Harris was born in Tampa, Florida, on June 17, 1935, to Walter Ira Harris and Ruth Hope Duss. They moved to Birmingham 1 year later, where his father managed a shoe store. His mother abandoned Ed and his father when Ed was just 18 months old. She ran off with one of his father's employees. In his book, Miracle in Birmingham, Ed said of these circumstances, "I attribute my sensitivity to the sufferings of others to that moment of abandonment. It made me wary, watchful, careful, fearful. I questioned everything." In fact, his questioning nature earned him a reputation very early in life. Always one for a good argument or debate, one of his elementary school teachers remarked, "Edward, you would argue with a signpost." Sometime after divorcing, his father married Mary Elizabeth Smith, whom Ed always referred to as his mother. In 1951, Ed enrolled for his last 2 years of high school at Marion Military Institute, where he graduated at age 17. It was here that he began to seriously question Alabama's norm of segregation, and his questioning began to morph into mild opposition. He said, "I knew the black people who lived and worked among us were at some disability, hated by some, feared by others, and ignored by all who could ignore them. Still, I had faith in the American dream and Christian principles, as well as simple notions of fairness as the tools of democracy that would right many of our racial problems. Those were the simple, even naive beliefs that were to bring me into conflict later with the laws of my city, its leadership, its police, and its racial ethos." Growing up in that environment, Ed said, "I noted its irrational aspects, but assumed that somehow adults must know what they were doing. Very early in life, I knew something was wrong with the system, but I didn't know what. Since the disabilities of the system did not fall on me, but rather I was the beneficiary of the system, I did not inquire too closely. For me, it was a gradual education in the perniciousness of a system that came down to us out of the past." To better understand that past that Ed referred to, let's go back a little further in Alabama's history. As Congress and the U.S. Supreme Court struggled with the legacy of emancipation, Southern states quietly began to implement the first building blocks of segregation. Railway cars were an early target in the 1870s and 1880s. Trains began to shift from being reserved for ladies to being reserved for white passengers. As these practices became more widespread, many Southern states, including Alabama, passed laws mandating racial segregation, including segregation of schools, churches, medical practices, residential areas, and even cemeteries. Heaven forbid that there be interracial mingling among the dead. Custom, backed up by the threat of violence from the police or lynch mobs, ensured that these laws were strictly enforced. State laws were also passed barring interracial marriage. Now, as a side note, interracial marriage was legalized nationally in 1967, but a ban on interracial marriage was still written into the state constitutions of 17 states, including Alabama. In the year 2000, Alabama became the last state to officially repeal the law. But the vote was far from resounding, with 40% of the populace voting against the repeal of the law. While working toward his bachelor's degree in history from Birmingham Southern College, Ed was editor of the school newspaper, where he soon discovered that he was more than just a questioner. He was a dissenter. He once invited Arthur Shores, an attorney for the NAACP, to speak to a school club. The next morning, Ed was summoned to the office of the director of public relations, who told Ed he was in deep trouble. "You're making life very hard on me," the director told him. He went on to say that Ed could even be suspended or expelled if it happened again. "We are subject to the law here, Ed," said the director, and the law was complete segregation. The following year, Ed attended a meeting to report about a group that opposed integration. A Klansman spoke at the meeting and received a rousing reception. When Ed ran his editorial in the school paper, he suggested in the mildest possible terms that the school should not align itself with the Klan. Again, he was called on the carpet and given the, "Oh, you're making life hard on me," speech. Somehow, Ed managed to persist at Birmingham Southern and earn his degree in 1957. He followed that up with a master's in history from Tulane University in 1960. Ed worked for a number of newspapers throughout his college days and beyond, then went to Washington, D.C. in late 1961 to work as a research assistant for Democratic Representative George Huddleston, Jr. In 1962, he ran a congressional office for Huddleston, the same year that George Wallace was elected governor of Alabama. Ed's main job was to run Huddleston's reelection campaign in a statewide Democratic primary featuring 9 candidates vying for 8 seats. In the end, Huddleston garnered the most votes of the 8 that were elected. Ed left Washington in 1963 to return to Birmingham and dive headfirst into civil rights work. Ed was a founder and president of the Alabama Civil Liberties Union and also served on the board of the American Civil Liberties Union. He pioneered voter registration campaigns in Birmingham following the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. He was a board member of the Birmingham Council on Human Relations and served on Birmingham's first anti-poverty committee. But his civil rights and political activities came at a high cost. Ed suffered beatings, he was jailed, and his life and the lives of his family were threatened. The homes of some of his colleagues were bombed, and he never knew when his might be next. All of this domestic terrorism was allowed to occur under the watch, or we might say blind eye, of a police commissioner with a national reputation as an overt racist. Let me introduce you to the man whose profound influence on Ed cannot be overstated, Eugene Bull Connor. Bull Connor was a radio sportscaster before entering state politics in 1934. Connor entered the Democratic primary race for a seat in the Alabama House of Representatives. Claiming that his candidacy was just a lark, Connor rarely campaigned, but his name recognition as a radio personality helped him to win the election. Connor served in the legislature from 1935 to 1937, and in 1937, he was elected Birmingham's Commissioner of Public Safety, a position that gave him administrative authority over the police and fire departments, schools, public health service, and libraries. To the white public, he presented himself as a champion of the working people, a tireless crime fighter, and an uncompromising defender of segregation. He won re-election to the city commission in 1941, 45, and 49. In 1950, Connor ran unsuccessfully for governor, then returned to his work as commissioner. He did not seek re-election to the commission in 1953 because of a scandal involving an extramarital affair and charges of police corruption. But he was voted back on the commission in 1957. A staunch and sometimes flamboyant white supremacist, Connor was known for making outrageous comments to the press and for instigating now famous confrontations over Birmingham segregation ordinances. While apparently not a member of the Ku Klux Klan, Connor protected Klansmen who committed racial violence, including bombings. In 1961, Connor ordered Birmingham police to stay away from the Trailways bus station while Klansmen attacked the Freedom Riders. This attack, along with other tactics employed by Connor to enforce segregation, significantly worsened Birmingham's national reputation and turned the local business community and a majority of the white electorate against Connor. In 1962, the citizens voted to change the form of city government, in part to remove him from office. But Connor would remain in office until late May of 1963, when his lawsuit to retain office was denied by the Alabama Supreme Court. But he had one more act of treachery up his sleeve before leaving office. What became known as the Children's Crusade began on May 2, 1963, when 1,000 students left their classes to march in downtown Birmingham. When they marched again the next day, Bull Connor ordered fire hoses and attack dogs to be used against them. Images of the resulting mayhem appeared on television and in newspapers throughout the country and helped shift public opinion in favor of national civil rights. Bull Connor died as a result of a stroke in 1973, still unrepentant about his defense of racial segregation. When I had conversations with Ed about his civil rights activities of the 1950s and 1960s, Bull Connor's name was almost always mentioned. I have no doubt that the hateful, violent grip that Connor held on Birmingham had much to do with fueling the resistance and resolve of Ed Harris. Well, thus far, I've focused on Ed's involvement with the civil rights movement through the 1950s and 60s because those were formative years that really helped shape the man. So what was his path that led him to eventually become our founding minister? Ed and his family left Birmingham in 1965 under less than ideal circumstances. In fact, he referred to it as an exile rather than a move. He said his family had been threatened many times through the years, but a telephone threat he received in November of 1964 proved to be transformational. There was nothing new or creative about the ugly language used by the caller, but for some reason, Ed took this one more seriously. He surprised even himself when he turned to his family as he hung up the phone and said, "I've just been called to the ministry. Someone is telling me I'd better get out of town." The next morning, his wife, Sandra, left with one of their sons to stay with friends in Mobile. Ed took the other two children to Sandra's parents' house in Nashville. When they arrived, Ed could hear the phone ringing in the house as he turned the door key. When he answered the phone, a voice said, "Thought you could get away from us? We know exactly where you are and where you're going. We're not finished with you." Up until then, Ed had always doubted the rumors about their phones being tapped, but it was clear that there were people who knew where Ed was going and when he would arrive. Once he got the children to safety, Ed returned to Birmingham the next day. While he had made up his mind about pursuing the ministry, he felt he still had some unfinished obligations to fulfill in Birmingham. Ed eventually entered Tufts University's theological school, where he earned a Master of Divinity degree. He was called by the Arlington Street Church in Boston, where he was ordained on November 3, 1968, and served as the minister there until 1970. He was then called to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign in Urbana, Illinois, from 1970 to 1983. He experienced another long run as minister of All Souls Unitarian Church in Indianapolis from 1984 to 1992. There, he was bestowed with the title of Minister Emeritus in 1992. He worked as an interim minister at Cedar Lane Unitarian Universalist Church in Bethesda, Maryland in 1992 and 1993, the Unitarian Church of Evanston, Illinois from 1993 to 95, the Unitarian Universalist Congregation of Shelter Rock in Manhasset, New York in 1987, and the Unitarian Universalist Church of Indianapolis in 2003 and 2004. He also consulted on healthcare issues at the UUA in 1997 and 1998. But most importantly for us, Reverend Ed Harris was the minister who helped establish the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County here in Danville. Of course, we weren't in Danville then. We were a small handful of people meeting in the homes of Nancy Renner Kennedy, Dan Derrick, and Susan Baggerly, and eventually at the Roland Manor Assisted Living Center in Brownsburg. We were trying to feel our way through the process of starting a congregation, and someone invited Ed to one of our meetings for guidance. Ed saw the potential in our little group and began meeting with us weekly, starting each gathering with an abbreviated UU service before discussing organizational issues and strategies. Each week was begun with the sounding of Ed's gong, which became a gift to our church. By the time we started meeting at Roland Manor, we had evolved to a service that was taking a definite structure. Ed continued to serve us as an unpaid volunteer minister, generously giving of his time and wealth of knowledge and experience, the depths of which I don't think any of us fully understood. Ed was a humble man who didn't talk a lot about what he endured through the 50s and 60s, or of his many accomplishments that I've outlined today. Ed very much believed in focusing on the present, the here and now. This was reflected when he said in his book, Garage Sale of the Mind, "We are living all the time. We are living when we are driving to work, watching television, or eating. We are living, breathing human beings, but we're hardly aware of it. We need to wake up. We need to take time to live." This was also the underlying theme of his book, How You Can Have a Good Day Every Day, even if you make other plans. We have these books on our shelves in our overflow room here, and I encourage you to check them out and read them. A dedicated and engaging writer and poet, Reverend Harris published 7 books before he passed away on August 10th, 2012, at the age of 77. We honor Reverend Ed Harris with his portrait on our wall of ministers. For those of us who knew him, we treasure our memories of him as he moved us along toward establishing this church. For Ed, there were no barriers, only minor speed bumps. I don't remember ever hearing him say, "We can't do that." I'm sure his struggles and victories in the civil rights movement had a lot to do with his attitude that success was eventually inevitable. I want to close with these words from Reverend Ed Harris. "My little philosophy is to do the best I can, here and now, letting the future take care of itself, to be grateful for life's possibilities, and to know that all triumphs and tragedies will change into something else. So I must too. Acceptance, courage, forgiveness, hope, gratitude, and learning. These are the head notes of my philosophy of being human. And there's one more thing. to admit that I often fail to meet even these expectations, but to persist and persevere.